There's some feelings there, you know, about being occupied and being colonized. And I think typically when we look at the history of the United States, it is a very similar of occupy, control, and destroy. This colonization is based on that, you know, being native means that you are politically affiliated with a sovereign nation, and that sovereign nation needs to be destroyed in order for the United States to prosper. And so that was, you know, 300 years of the United States beginning was a complete and total enemy of the indigenous folks. And in California is, you know, the atrocity and the like grossness of the genocide that took place here. And during that time, you know, the United States decided that, you know, not only that it would, not only would it turn its own people, it went straight to Willie Lynch's, you know, type. It was going to turn the old against the young, the dark skin against the light skin, the rich against the poor, the house workers against the field workers. That whole mentality was extremely pushed on the United and the Native community here, and as well as slavery. And so the ugliness of the United States policies and the racism and the just downright ethnic cleansing that took place in California not too long ago, they built these boarding schools where all these kids had to go in. And the motto of these boarding schools is kill the Indian, save the man. And this is a United States endorsed policy. So when we talk about schools having the worst policy, you're talking about United States founded boarding schools for Native students. The hundreds of thousands of students, and they died at these boarding schools. They were taken care of, at the least, but to say they were taken care of, they were property of the government, and they were held in held in trust to churches. And we have Southern California, Northern California had a different system, but basically Sherman is one of those boarding schools. And so, kill the Indian, save the man, was a motto that the United States definitely pushed on children. And so this type of overlaps in time when you come into my, I'm, you know, born in 74, you know, missed a lot of, you know, government policies through Northern Valley Indian Health of forced hysterectomies on Native women. One out of five women were forced hysterectomies, forced sterilization in the United States in the 1970s. So this policy is continued on and on. People think, oh, this is back in John Wayne's day. No, this happened, you know, back even when I was born in 74. So when I get into college and I start learning about all this, kill the Indian, save the man, policies, you know, just attacking movements like AIM, you know, the government was just has been, to me, in such bad faith and not upheld any other trust agreements or treaty agreements they ever did. It just made me feel really disgusted. And how we were taught in history, not only the holidays that we've had, but even you know, the way that we were taught that children were in school. So to say that, you know, after all that, people have been whitewashed, it seemed like, whoa, you know. And I go into college and I find out that the professor at Chico State is going to be calling my great, great, great grandmother prehistoric, because she was here before John Bidwell, and I am some modern Indian because I'm here with white folks. And sometimes being in a room or being in a community with white folks makes me a modern Indian, you know? And that association to me is a bunch of bullshit. And I think that that's where you first have to start decolonizing your mind is, you know, it is that posture of being so important that you change even the label of the Native people around you.
Yes.
You know? And so Thanksgiving is about looking at that hierarchy, that condition that we've all been told that, you know, there's some kind of whiteness is some kind of rightness, and whiteness is some kind of like change and change agent in the community. And what it is it's just what it is. There is no hierarchy that brown and white should not have one better than the other. It should be more acculturation, not assimilation. And so it's really hard because working what I'm doing, I want to talk about assimilation, but acculturate this knowledge. And so because we live in such, you know, because there was the boarding school, because there's a difference between a prehistoric Indian and a modern Indian, because of all these labels, it's really hard to get people to really focus on the fact that we're supposed to be acculturating our knowledge together. You know, yeah, I like to drive a car. Yeah, I like to have a refrigerator. Yeah, I like electricity. But guess what? Don't you like to have good herbs growing in your park that you can gather as well, and things that you can make from the earth, and a business that you can like pretty much propagate out of the ecosystem around you?
Don't you like to breathe?
Yeah, benefit mutually. So that we can have a little bit of best of both worlds without it being whitewashed, and that even the presence of whiteness shouldn't change any native's identity.
This is Corey Hunt with Sapien Sessions, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, educator, and activist Ali Mitters Knight.
What are some other experiences, you know, politically and economically as a native in modern day America?
So, you know, I was talking earlier about kind of how, like, state of California, you had Governor Brown, who came in after Schwarzenegger and was really, like, having to, you know, when we have a governor who has zero understanding of federal Indian law and trying to control tribes and casinos, what started to happen was the whole state of California started seeing California Indian casinos on their ballot. And so what they started to realize is they were voting to do what natives should do on their land. And that is essentially the definition of colonization, to take over political control of an indigenous land. That is the textbook definition of colonization. And California attempted to do it right in front of our faces on their ballot, you know? And so people were really so detached from colonization mm-hmm. and its effect on Native people mm-hmm. that they would actually, and they'll even sit down to coffee and tell you what they feel about casinos and what they think what tribes should do with their mm-hmm. land. You know, mm-hmm. and what tribes should do and what tribes should be, and have all this kind of advice and not realizing the toes they're stepping on and not even realizing, like, that is colonization, mm-hmm. you know. And so when I look at America changing, when I look at people changing, I kind of go back to my first time coming to Chico and walking through Bidwell Park. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what was around me. I would walk through, I was walking by plants, I was walking by trees, mm-hmm. I was walking around all kinds of stuff. I didn't know what I was looking at. I didn't know clue what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, just, you know, hanging out with my friends. I just can't wait to hit the weed, you know. We were just trying to hang out and do stuff. I wasn't paying attention to the plants or what needed to go on. Mm-hmm. But over time, because of my experience, because of working with elders, being a basket weaver, going out and having to look and find and seek and, you know, having that adventure constantly, I changed. So when I walk in the park has never changed. The park is still the same. Those plants are there. It's me that changed. I have different eyes. I have a different way of walking through that park and seeing what's there and seeing what's sick and seeing what's well and seeing what's good and seeing what's bad. And that's the difference. And I think that even comes down to wholeheartedly what this town, this city of Chico has been dealing with having homeless people living in the park. That's all they see. Mm-hmm. They don't see the oak. They don't see, you know, they don't even see that there's oleander taking over areas that don't belong there. Mm-hmm. They don't see a lot of invasive species coming over, and Himalaya blackberry and ivy, English ivy going all, you know, they don't see that. Mm-hmm. They don't even, their eyes, what they see is homeless people sleeping in their public spaces. Mm-hmm. And that is a violation of their sense of security. Yes. And so that goes back to the innate relationship they had with natives.
Yes.
Natives not owning land, but living amongst them in some mm-hmm. woods. And they were like, what if I have to go from grandma's house to uncle's house and I encounter natives living wildly out there? So in order to do that, every native had to be killed. It was a bounty. And so California paid $5 for every scalp of Native Americans. And we're talking 250,000 people. You know,
and can't distinguish a scalp from a woman or a man or a child. And so, yeah, there's often children getting claimed as adults where it's supposed to not be.
And anybody had dark hair. Mm. You're having an accountability of people that just genetically are native. You're looking at Chinese, Kanaka, Hawaiians that were here. Mm-hmm. All of them, their scalps could pass for native scalps. Mm-hmm. So people were just with genetic ethnic cleansing. They were getting their scalps cut and being sent in. And that is a policy. That is the very first bond measure of California. So California, its foundation, mm-hmm. its genesis, its seed is genocide. And so based on that, you know, it's like being in a relationship with someone. You're like, he's a great guy. Eh, he's a little serial killer. Yeah. Should I take it into account? He don't want to kill me. He killed other people. I'm not his enemy.
There you go. There you go. I hear that one often for sure.
If you're just joining us, this is Corey Hunt speaking with Ali Mitters Knight, Machupta tribal member, educator, and activist on KZFR.
When people think of the genesis of California, they often whitewash it, and it's the beautiful gold rush in a prosperous time. And when you think of the gold rush, what comes to mind?
What I think is mercury poisoned pioneers doing weirdish, weird mercury poisoned people who then enslave other people who get involved in the slave of not only gold but silver. And get involved with slave trades and human trafficking all the way throughout here, not only from Mexico, for up here. And I just think of exploitation. I think of dirty, ugly politics. And, yeah, mercury poisoning and just the Mad Hatter type, you know, just like insane in the membrane, you know. And those people were making decisions about who gets to live and die in this area for the longest time. And they were ticked off on mercury. And they passed that mercury on to their kids. So we got a lot of mercury-poisoned settler descendants running around here making decisions as well. And I'm not saying natives don't have the same ailment, but I know it is what it is, and that's the history. So when I think of Gold Rush, I just think of poisoning and dredging and ripping apart and taking apart creeks and rivers and just being like a complete, what do you call it? Like a raping of the land.
Pillaging, yeah. So with that pillaging, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, rectifying and that dreaded word, reparations? You know, what are the ideas and your thoughts around that?
Well, I've thought a lot about it, you know. Mostly I think about it when I read books like The Art of War, you know, 48 Laws of Power. And then I try to think of strategies of how to rectify the situation in the correct way, because it has to be good, it has to have integrity, and it has to be pretty much inviting, also within the laws of seduction, that everybody feels like they got a piece of it. So it isn't until you kind of realize that you have to wait for a moment of crisis to intervene. You kind of have to wait for everyone to be vulnerable and willing to listen to you, because that takes time. You know, at first I've been out there talking for a minute and everyone's just like, psh, this crazy girl, oh my gosh, you know?
I know.
And I'm offending, you know, a lot of people, like, you're occupying Machupta territory, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I started off being really raw. So then when the crisis came for the campfire, what I really saw was this county had 180,000 acres of federal forest. That's federal forest. It's not county. It's within the county, but it's not owned by the county.
Sure.
It is actually in trust to the federal government. And the forestry is basically, delegated to handle that with very small budget, with a very teeny tiny budget. And a lot of times the projects that I have are like, you know, really like, they're, what would you call, Band-Aid projects. They don't really do what you need them to do for the long period, sustainable. So they'll go up and do a ridge and do like a huge fire break to save a community. But that's what they're going to do once every 50 years. So it doesn't take but more than 50 years for that whole line to overgrow and be, you know, so the maintenance of that, just doing something one time. And that's basically how those forest projects are coming on. So there's just no long-term maintenance on that. So then I'm looking at the 2018 Farm Bill. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So the provisions in there allow tribes under the Marshall Trilogy to have a nation-to-nation relationship with the federal government on federal land. And from that, they can do goods for services. But they need a partner with everybody. So it's taken me quite a many years to get the partnership and everything built together for everyone to realize, okay, all of our major forest fires, wildfires in California, all start on federal land. On federal forest land. And even in the campfire, we're talking about federal forest land that wasn't maintained, that encroached in on a, you know, populated urban or, you know, city or town, and you know, and devastated it. And the governor, state of California, the county, the city municipals, the town of Paradise, all these places just don't have the gunpowder to get all of the work done on federal land. They're just worried about county land. They're just worried about municipals. They're just learning about private property. And that takes up hundreds of thousands of acres as itself. So tribes to be able to say, hey, let's work with you on this 180,000 acres just in Butte County alone. And see if we can make this a safer place. These contracts with the federal government are 20-year stewardship contracts. They used to be 7 to 9 years. So now we're going into 20 years of stewardship contracting on land out here. And so if we actually had a whole work crews working for 20 years on large, vast pieces of land, on federal land, to reduce the fire and to bring things into the community, we would have a game changer here. And so we've got investors coming in from Sierra Institute. We've got partners with the Fire Safe Council and CHIPS and just basically a lot of certified workforce development programs. And we're trying to build one here. We have an $8 million proposal to basically build this like SEAL team that have fire certifications, forestry, basically Sawyer certifications, and then TEK, traditional ecological knowledge on invasive and native plants, how they're adapted, and doing watershed restoration.
This is Corey Hunt with Sapien Sessions, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, educator, and activist Allie Mitters-Knight.
And you keep answering my questions before I ask them. And, that's pretty awesome. So I appreciate you taking this time and sharing your wealth of knowledge with our community. It's really priceless. You mentioned TEK. What is that?
So TEK is traditional ecological knowledge. Mm-hmm. And like, so in 2009, I went to California Indian Manpower Consortium, CIMC. Mm-hmm. I went to their entrepreneur leadership and entrepreneurial and tribal leadership, you know, training program. It was 6 months long. And I got to go to stay in a week at all these different Indian reservation hotels in California. And so I spent a week studying with these business, Harvard Business School volunteers who come to work with Indian country. So most of the time, everybody, when I got there, people had their own business ideas. So most everyone there had like this one-page business plan to put together. And we have bouncy houses, jewelry, florists, taco trucks, tattoo artists, you know, coming in for the training. So my business plan was to do a certification program for land management using TEK, traditional ecological knowledge. Mm-hmm. And in 2009, it was crickets in the room when I said that. No one knew what I was talking about, how that was, and I just sounded like a nerd bird. you know, I just sounded like I was all official nerd. And I really had a hard time doing my, you know, 1 minute elevator speech, putting a one page business plan, because what it really incorporated was this huge model, like a movement. So it took me 6 months to basically develop this huge model movement. And I cried because I thought there was no way that what I developed could come to life. Mm-hmm. Like, who? I have 5 kids, you know, and at the time I had 4 kids, so I had a kid since then. but I had 5 kids. 4 kids, I didn't think that there was so much money involved. Mm. You know, millions and millions of dollars. And I just, in my mind, I just didn't associate myself with that kind of wealth to get the projects done. So, and that was good, because being less ambitious, I was willing to actually learn more and get my feet wet and go out and work on projects and start working with partnerships in Chico State and Butte College and, you know, make all these marks and then go to the tribe and say, hey, look, I've got a plan, and then meet that plan and do presentation after presentation after presentation. So it took me nearly 9 years to get what I wrote all the way up to where I was introducing it to people. And now I'm on this whole year of it. Actually, people are putting like millions of dollars into it. Mm-hmm. And it's not my money. I don't have millions of dollars at all. But the goal is always is to get people trained and certified for jobs. Mm-hmm. I think the Green New Deal is a great idea, but it hasn't been actualized. Mm-hmm. And TEK is a certification that tribes can do. Each tribe can do their own certification. And I look at it like this. We're a sovereign nation, mm-hmm. you know, and California is a sovereign, right? California gives out, issues driver's license. California issues haircutting licenses, you know, like tattoo, everything you can think of. California is going to make you go get a license for that and get a certification for you to be licensed. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is that tribes should have certifications, and you're going to have a license to work on federal land in our territory. But if you do, you should be paid well, And you should also have those certifications that you can take throughout your career in other places. So say here in California, you work in Machupta territory, we might have a consortium with other tribes, which we do, to do this certification. So when tribes are putting together land management or you have a land management crew, you're not only certified to do fire, but you're certified to do forestry. And when you walk onto that place, you're able to identify what trees are there, what plants are there, and what plants need to go and what plants need to stay and why.
This is Corey Hunt with Sapien Sessions, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, educator, and activist Allie Mitters-Knight.
That's a very interesting point. It's so much ignorance around our surroundings. I mean, myself included, I'm embarrassed of my level of knowledge of the life and the friends around me. And you have a wealth of that information, but it shouldn't be on you to educate all of us. And so what do you suggest that folks do to educate themselves?
You know, for my journey, I had to be willing, first of all, to always forgive myself for not being perfect at this. You know, there's no idealness behind it. This is a really a let go of ego and kind of reforming yourself. So and I used this analogy before the other day, and I guess this is the best way I can do it again. And I like this analogy. Is there's a difference between people that work in a nursing home and the people that visit a nursing home.
Sure.
So the people that work in the visit nursing home know everybody who lives there. Mm-hmm. They know their schedule. They kind of know what foods they like and what they don't like, and if they have a lot of visitors, if they're happy, if they're lonely, if they have dementia, if they don't. Mm-hmm. All those key things, if they're sick. So, and then someone who's visiting only knows one person, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And they're only there for that. And they really don't know what's going on with everybody. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's a difference of like going into the woods and being like, okay, I'm going to visit one thing. Or I'm going to go, I know what's going on here. I know everything that's going on with everybody. Mm-hmm. And so there's a difference between walking into a nursing home that you work at than where you visit. And there's a difference between going into a park or a woodland and an ecosystem that you work at, mm-hmm. or that you just visit. And so, to me, yeah, that's that responsibility. And you don't have to take it all on. You don't mm-hmm. have to be the cook and the counselor and the director. You know, just find your role in that place that you can do to help out. And it's a humbling thing because, you know, nobody walks into a nursing home doing it all. Mm-hmm. You know, but also, I was to say, also people don't walk into nursing homes and tennis shoes and run in random directions visiting nobody. So
There you go. That is such a precise analogy. My gosh. That is amazing.
Yeah, who's weird now? I think Gabe just ran through here in his tennis shoes. She's not even visiting Meemaw.
Stay tuned to KZFR for more of this special edition of Sapient Sessions with Allie Mitters-Knight here on Chico's Peace and Social Justice Show.
All right. And we're going to have the next two segments coming up. It's noon right now. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond on occupied Machupta land. I'd like to thank Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farmstar Pizza at 2359 the Esplanade, at farmstarpizza.com, and on Facebook. The phone number to order is 343-2056, and also want to thank Tires Plus, Complete Auto Repair. Chico's Downtown Automotive Repair Center on the corner of 6th and Broadway, the old Smith Tire location. Tires Plus offers Cooper, Michelin, and more, and vehicle repair service for cars, trucks, and SUVs at 624 Broadway Street. Tires Plus can be reached by calling 342-8338, or you can find them on Facebook. Let's return to this interview. Here you go.
This Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m.
Sorry. I'll just play this really quick. No.
108 Sherman Avenue.
Actually, no. Hang on.
Too. So if you're hungry, please come and join the angels and get a plate and some dessert all to go. They will have turkey, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, candied yams, rolls, baked mac and cheese, pumpkin pie, cake, and cookies. Warm hat and mittens also while supplies last. This Wednesday, in fact, every other Wednesday until at least the end of January 2021, the Stonewall Alliance is having a teens trans night from 6:30 to 8 p.m. If you're a trans teen, come join and meet other teenagers and just be yourself at the Stonewall Alliance, 358 East 6th Street in Chico. At MONCA, the Museum of Northern California Art in Chico, they're excited to be participating in the North Valley Community Foundation's North Valley Week of Giving, a region-wide fundraising event open to all nonprofit public charities in Butte, Tehama, Colusa, and Linn counties, as well as charitable funds from the North Valley Community Foundation. There's more information to be had at monca.org. Now, on Thursday, Thanksgiving morning, there's an event called Babies Love Books at the Butte County Library Oroville branch. This, again, is from Thursday from 10:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. at 1820 Mitchell Avenue in Oroville. Babies and parents will enjoy connecting through rhymes, songs, and books during a program created especially for them. No signups are necessary, and it is presented by the Butte County Library Literary Services. Sharing Choices and Coast, the coordinated outdoor assistance and shelter team, are accepting donations of sleeping bags, tarps, socks, hats, jackets, and other insulated items for those in need as the temperatures plummet and the rainy season begins. New or slightly used clean items are being accepted at Caring Choices at 1398 Ridgewood Drive on November 23rd through 25th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Our Hand Sculpture at East 4th and Main Street across from City Hall in the Plaza. And on the weekend of the 28th and 29th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., monetary donations are also being accepted. Distribution of items is taking place at the Our Hand Sculpture, again, East 4th and Main Street, on the weekend of November 28th and 29th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. If you have an event that you'd like on the community calendar, let us know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
Welcome to the second part of this special edition of Sapient Sessions. I'm Corey Hunt, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, educator, mother, and activist Allie Mitters Knight. As we rejoin the session, Allie explains her thoughts on the prison industrial complex.
So, in 1999, my relationship with Christopher Knight, who is my husband, where my name Allie Knight comes from, he was in CYA in Whittier. And in Whittier, in CYA, he got charged and he was sentenced to prison time. So he went from 15 into CYA, and then from a few years in CYA, he was sentenced to 6 years, which he had to serve at least half of that, if not more than that, all of it, and the California State Men's Penitentiary. So he was pretty much state property from then. So I was supportive with him. We ended up getting married in Susanville. And so I was young. I was starting college. I had my oldest daughter, Nia, and I was working also at the Machupta tribe and learning basket weaving. And it kind of helped to have, I hate to say this, but to have a long distance relationship because my life was so busy. I really didn't really have time to have, to take care of house and be a wife and do some of what we would consider womanly duties in the home all day. I could pretty much get up in the morning and go to school, go to work, talk to my husband on the phone, go gathering, do what I got to do, and just have a super busy life and just focus on my time when I could manage my own time for myself. But what I really learned about the prison industrial complex was the suffering that he went through from CYA to the penitentiary, just adjusting his personality and himself to the environment that he was in. And he wasn't gang-related, so he was Native. So there was almost like a movement in your ethnicity in prison dominates who you are. So, you know, we don't realize that we live in a life where, you know, nobody says this is the blocks where the whites live, and then this is the blocks where the blacks live, and this is the blocks where the, you know, northern Mexicans and the southern Mexicans and the Natives and the others. Mm-hmm. But that's how prison is set up, and that's how California prisons are set up. And the California prison is the largest prison industrial complex in the whole world. Mm-hmm. So this is set up huge. And we have such a high population of not only Native men in those prisons, and I could see it from Chris's perspective, but I could see all the other. And what seems to be the smallest percentage in prisons was the whites. So they have a minority, but they're segregated. So that creates a lot of friction and anger and animosity at that level. Mm-hmm. And I ironically saw how whites and Natives got along in prison way farther than I realized. Mm. Or it like kind of surprised me. And so I saw the whole system and his continued doing time and everyone doing time. And I saw how easy it was to get sucked into the system and never be able to get out. And then I was there when he went on parole, and I went through the whole parole process and, you know, his parole officer taking pictures of his tattoo. And they were like, looked at me and told me, the parole officer said, we've taken these pictures so that we could identify his dead body. Mm. And he was shot and killed by Salt Lake police in a shootout. They claim that he shot the police. Two officers were shot by him. I don't believe their story. They're not coming up with video camera of what happened. So until I see the footage of it, I'm just going to believe what they say is fabricated. Mm-hmm. But he was shot multiple times in 2014. And we have, our daughter was 6 years old, and we'd split up, but we were still in good communication and friends. Mm-hmm. And so the prison industrial complex was always something that angered me. I kind of like dabbled and read about it and certain things. But once he died, I really, really, really started to see and read about it and know about it and get really, really angry about the suffering that took place. And basically a whole man's human life from 15 to 34, he was property of the state. Mm. And they pretty much killed him at the end, like Running Man, like some horrible nightmare where the government's always out to kill you or trap you or put you in a cage or make you conform and the best you can make out of it. And for the state of California, that's their top industry. Mm. Top, number one, next to selling water, is human trafficking and the prison industrial complex. So it's unfortunate that our vice president of the United States is associated with human trafficking at the prison industrial complex level, because that's how I see it. And it was profiteering and money-making, just like the gold rush, just like everything else. It's horrible.
This is Corey Hunt, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, activist, and educator, Allie Mitters Knight.
You mentioned when you were describing the segments of prisons with the segregations of it, the other. And that reminded me of during the political process when Natives were described as quote unquote something else. Mm-hmm. What was that like to hear your peoples described as something else?
My first reaction was that, to me it was almost like that person that's like trying to be politically correct and can't do it right, you know, where they're like, well, we can't say Indians. And they said, well, someone's there's something else. So they're like, something else. And not wanting to offend anybody. So a lot of times I get that. They're like, does the word Native American offend you, or American Indian, or Indian, or, you know, what is the right word to use in terms? So when I saw that, I thought that was just like a total like idiot move by CNN. Mm-hmm. just because somebody was like, well, just say something else and it'll be, you know, like appropriate. But yeah, it did correlate back to what I understood about prisons, and that they do label, you know, you have, you know, blacks, whites, and even when they segregate, you know, Mexican, Northern Mexican, Southern Mexican, when they do these things in prison, you can easily tell that when they say others and Native, that it is interesting because it's not a gang affiliation, it's a political affiliation, and that is, that would make them political prisoners.
Mm. Indeed. I mean, you look at the military and their use of Native names in their weaponry, like their jets and their missiles. I always thought that was very, growing up being uneducated, I thought it was very strange. But as I've grown up, it's become a little bit more overt, the reasoning behind that. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that if you had anything, any thoughts around it.
Yeah, there's a lot of philosopher, Native philosophers, Vine DeLorean, and a lot of really deep thinkers that talk in about, you know, how, you know, the United States has appropriated Native words into their, to their, you know, helicopters, into their aircrafts, into their machineries, and even into their terms of, you know, leaving the reservation and getting on the reservation, off the reservation.
Indian and, territories.
Yeah, and territories and stuff that were done. These political terms of appropriation, you know, they're often not understood to be the direct insult for colonization. So that though, and it is also like the changing and twisting of terms.
Mm.
So, you know, the only thing I can think of is that to make it their own and to, mm, to take part of it. So, say when you before when you would get paid $505 to kill a Native and take their scalp.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can't take their scalp, but you can take their names,
mm,
and make money off of it. Mm. And you can use those things. Anything that you can take, you can take, and it. It becomes, that's how I see it, where it's just a flex of domination. It's the patriarch flexing and showing you that, you know, he has taken your name and he has changed it.
This is Corey Hunt, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, activist, and educator, Allie Mitters-Knight. As we sit on our porch, I apologize for the noises in the background. I hope they're not too disturbing from the information she's sharing.
So I wanted to give you a chance to speak to just, you know, the, you know, how you rarely hear people mention how we stopped doing what had been working for a long time when we came in with colonialism and we didn't take advantage of the practices that everyone supposedly is celebrating here on Thanksgiving, that we had learned, that the natives had taught us, but we're not utilizing those practices. And when we talk about these forest fires and things like that, it's so rare that we hear anything like that mentioned. Would you like to speak to that?
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about climate change,
mm-hmm,
you know, we're talking climate change is part of human history, or part of the Earth's history. Climate has changed on this planet, on its existence. This is the first climate change that is incited and made by man.
Mm.
And the via, the Latin word, by way of man-made climate change is colonization and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And capitalism and colonization are basically, you know, in bed together, you know, to breed financial dominance and wealth and prosperity overtly over a group of people in order to enslave them and to profit from them and turn them into products. And they turn everything into products. The environment, anything you can think of, has to be turned into a product. And the product has to be served directly to the capital and to the colonizer. And so when we have that set up, that is not just the United States. That is Canada. That is Mexico. Everywhere you go, you're going to have colonization. You're going to have either a European-dominated colonizer. Even France is a colonizer. They're a little bit more apologetic than some of the other European countries, but colonization is what we've been dealing with on this earth. Philippines have been dealing with colonization. Thailand has been dealing with colonization. Everywhere. Japanese. There are people have been colonized by people that don't look American, that don't look European. They look just like them, and they're colonizers. And these colonizers have done this around the world. And it is so out of control that now we have a man-made climate change. And so in order to fix the climate change, we have to really go back to empowering indigenous people in your area to do land management and claim back to the land and put back into the land what needs to be there. And in order to do that, you have to acculturate and not assimilate. And since we're all brainwashed on this planet to assimilate, acculturate sounds like a really bad date, but it's a really good date, you know? You know, it's a really good date. It's a really good time, you know? And it's a really fresh and a way of looking at things. And this acculturation is just basically saying that your European white culture is not a bad culture. Mm-hmm. Your European culture is not horrible. Mm-hmm. And my native culture is not horrible. Mm-hmm. We both can share the best qualities so that we can have survival in a climate changing adaptation scenario. And before, in the 1980s and 90s, we were never going to get that scenario. We were getting it. You know, people were having too much time, good times. I mean, rap just started coming out. MTV was going on. You know, you got Save the Earth. You got some of those things, you know, Farm Aid, you know. Everybody was really kind of like on this whole different level. And then we forgot about Jimmy Carter's, you know, leave out. You know, we're about to hit a calamity environmentally based on glutton and greed and, you know, all of this bad behavior that we've been doing, you know, and oil leaks and, you know, exploiting pipelines and dredging up and all the creeks we can think of and damming them up. Geez, the United States have done so much dam building in the last, you know, 80 years that it's really clogged up and compromised the system and aquifers of the whole place, of the whole continent. And so, you know, this idea that you could go into church and, you know, sing your hymns with the Bible in front of you and smell like, you know, fresh cookies and Kool-Aid and think that God is going to save you from yourself, I don't think that that's what it is. Climate change is about you saving yourself with the people around you as a prayer, as an act of God. You know, you have to be together. You have to act together. I don't understand why people believe they're going to be saved. We can actually do ourselves in. We can actually hurt ourselves. And I'm sure that people have left their bodies at some point on this, you know, I can just feel it and realize that they let go of their life. They took it for granted and it's leaving them. And that it was precious. And we don't have to live with regret, and we definitely don't have to force that regret on our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and the next generation after us. So that's what I think climate change is really about. We're going to see a huge catastrophes happen. We're going to see bad calamities. But if we have no plan to work together with indigenous people and rebuild this area with these nations, then we have no plan at all. And that's what makes people crazy, I think. A lot of moms and dads out there, if there's one thing that'll make a mom and dad go nuts, is no plans.
This is Corey Hunt, and I'm speaking with Machupta tribal member, activist and educator, Allie Mitters-Knight.
So, on that note, what's the suggestions? What do we do? It's a lot of doom and gloom. I think that's what causes a lot of it, too. People are like, oh, they said that there's nothing we can do. I mean, subconsciously, I think a lot of this is happening where people are saying to themselves, I can't do anything about it, so I'm just going to put my head down and just enjoy my time. And so to kind of dispel the myth of there's nothing I can do, what do you encourage people to do? What can we, the average citizens, do to impact this atrocity?
Well, that was kind of my plan. I had to have a strategy. And being a basket weaver, strategy is also about picking the right sticks, getting them in order, putting them in the right piles. It takes a lot of patience, sometimes even a whole year, to get the sticks that you want to do the basket that you're going to do. Mm. So that patience and that time, I realized, okay, this is what I can do when I can take all my energies and knowledge and focus on getting people to sign on all these millions of dollars to get people to have a new life, a career. So instead of, you know, having, you know, an 18-year-old or a 17, like I've had teenagers, and they're like, what are you going to do for your life? You have A, you can join the military. B, you can go to college and get yourself a nice fat student loan and debt. Nice student loans and nice big huge debt for the rest of your life, and, you know, minimize your income for the rest of your life because you're paying back on what you're doing now. Or three, you can just go get a job somewhere. And what can you do? You can go get certifications. You can go get a trade. Because that's what's been missing out of our school systems for so long. When I was in school, you could go to shop and you could go get a certification to do plumbing. You could have all these new certifications so that when you graduated, you can get a job, an entry-level job with your entry-level certifications that you built through your, you know, through your teens. But instead, that's been removed. And so now it's just like college or you're a bum, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I thought that this is where the new workforce belongs. And with my work with unions, I said, why don't we build a workforce and unionize them at the same time? And say, okay, you guys are fire and you are forestry and then you're TEK, but you all have to share certifications, but then you should all be unionized and then demand and fight for your wages right now. So we'll start that model team and go. And also that takes the pressure off me because that's each one teach one. So once you get them into the fight where you're like, okay, you deserve $50 an hour, go get them. Everyone will fight for $50 an hour because they're like, I'm triple certified. Mm-hmm. I'm like a SEAL team, you know, land restoration. I want to be able to change the word and say, well, I have an option. I can join the military. I can go to college. I can pick up some certifications and become a land tech. And spend the rest of my life working and understanding the land and working on it for climate change. And that's where I think the Green New Deal needs to be in, is to looking at what model works and then spreading that across the United States. So what I'm willing to do is demonstrate and put down a model to see if they likey-likey.
In the third part of this session, Allie speaks to the TEK model she's been working on for years and much more. But first, this week's musical respite. This is Brother Ali's Own Light, a.k.a. Hearts of Four.
Greetings to all of you in the language of love, the universal language. Beauty is the splendor of truth. Use your hearts for what your hearts are for. Fill them with light. Do not fill them with darkness. The light of the human heart, when it's given faith, if it were opened up, it would blind the world. May this message give us eyes with which to see, ears with which to hear, and hearts with which to love each other and to love the world and to do good.
You're not using your heart for what hearts are for. They've been trying to shut us down our whole life. God for healing, you ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. Thank God for listening, listen, you've been trying to build me up my whole life. I thank God for building, you ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. I thank God I'm living, sometimes I feel like a stranger. Maybe I ain't from here, world going crazy, how could that be unclear? Know that I'm a soldier, hearts on my battleground, sword in the holster, had to come back around. Trying to hide away, I just had to meditate. I ain't got a lot to say, but the ancestors made. Speaking to the whole globe, numbers don't occur to me. You can listen solo, cause you're the whole world to me. I jump in with both feet, nothing low key. You can find me where I'm supposed to be, where my folks
listen very closely. You know who chose me. Nothing that I own owns me, and so I'm so free. I remember being hungry, needing groceries. Nighttime, getting no sleep till my nose bleed. Got a message to the police. You're not using your heart for what hearts are for. They've been trying to shut us down our whole life. I thank God for healing. You ain't gotta give me lit, I got my own life. Thank God for listening. Listen, you've been trying to build me up my whole life. I thank God for building. You ain't gotta give me lit, I got my own life. I thank God I'm living. Not for one second, I believe what you're telling me. I know you invent the disease and sell the remedy. Universe is sending me centuries of memories. So the very breath that I breathe is all I ever need. I got that Muhammad Ali up in my pedigree. Yes, I be speaking my peace up in my 70s. Ain't worried about you threatening me. I'm just being honest. I ain't buying fear just because it's all you got left. We just want to make love till we wake up. I believe whoever made us envisioned greatness. And you know they want to paint us with the same brush. Want to entertain us till we fill our grave up. All right, okay, but when it's all said and it's all done, and I look back at the trophies I won, I will only count one. I'm using my heart for what hearts are for. They've been trying to shut us down our whole life. I thank God for healing. You ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. Thank God for listening. Listen, you've been trying to build me up my whole life. I thank God for building. You ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. I thank God I'm living. And I know who I am, I know whose I am. On your wings I fly, in your shoes I stand. I'm animated by love, I don't move by chance. Any stage I touch, any place I stand, there y'all land, living in the world as it is. Cracked vessel I am, no more and no less than a man. Any possessions that I have are just in my hand. I balance them the best that I can. I'm not making no claims, but I'm using my heart for what hearts are for. All the beauty in this whole life. I thank God for healing. And you ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. I thank God for listening. Listen, you've been trying to build me up my whole life. I thank God for building. You ain't gotta get me lit, I got my own life. I thank God I'm living. Just reflecting all the beauty in this whole life.
This is FM 90.1 KZR.
What's good, people? Welcome to another episode of the Peace and Social Justice Show. I'm your co-host, Corey Hunt, reporting from occupied Machupta territory. Today, we share a conversation it was my honor to have in reverence to Native American Heritage Day.
Sorry. This is Chris. I'm playing an interview that Corey Himpont did with Ali Metters tonight. And stay tuned for Playing Dead at 1 o'clock. They'll be with you. And let me see if I can get this third segment on. It decided it wanted to play the first segment again. Let's see if I can get it.
As we near the culmination of Native Heritage Awareness Month.
Sorry.
For this special edition of Sapient Sessions on National Listening Day, I thought who better to listen to than the Machupta tribal member, mother, educator, and activist that has taught me so much about Native American history and culture.
Hang on, I'm going to figure this out yet. Here we go. Try it again.
The one and only Ali Metters Knight. As we sat on her porch on a crisp fall afternoon, Ali graciously shares her experiences, knowledge, and love for her people with our community. The conversation begins with Ali describing her thoughts on things.
Okay. This is Chris, and I am not very good on tech stuff. I'm just going to try one more thing here to see if I can get this computer to decide to switch gears and play what I'm asking it to play, which is the third segment, not the first, of this wonderful interview. That might have done it. Let's see if this is it.
So much gratitude to Ali Metters Knight for spending this time with us and sharing her grace, wisdom, and experience with our community. As we wrap up this interview, we jump into the final segment with Ali explaining a common misconception around native commodities.
People get it really messed up, but all Native American, especially federally recognized tribes, have a relationship with the federal government and in trust. And we are entitled to, mm-hmm. you know, somehow the whites thought that they were entitled, but we were written in there. Native Americans are entitled to food, healthcare, and housing. Mm-hmm. So that's why we have, you know, NAHASDA. That's why we have Northern Valley Indian Health, or we have Indian Health Services. And that's why we also are part of all of this USDA Farm Bill stuff. It's because we've gotten all these commodities. So there's free food that has to go out, and that's government. That is a responsibility of the government, and it's an entitlement from the tribes to have.
And is that reparations?
No, it's not. It's because they took it all away, mm-hmm. and they wanted to change the diet. Mm. So then you have all this commodity food, this government food, then you have dishes made from that, mm-hmm. but then you have to go back before pre-contact, what they call prehistoric. There you go again with uh-huh. this, like, you know, making people feel, I'm going to eat prehistoric food. And you're like, that really screws with people's head. You know, mm-hmm. all of a sudden they're like, am I going to taste some, like, rock in it or something? You know, like... There's just like this. I'm not kidding. Even my mind is like, so Natalie, you would like to eat some prehistoric food? I'm like,
That's by design, know? For sure, because it's not prehistoric. It's pre-colonial.
It's pre-colonial, so. Exactly. So then when you're looking at it, you're like, okay, this is what it is. This is what it is. So I am actually going to be talking about elderberry, which everybody's taking elderberry syrup. You know, mm-hmm. they know what that is. There's pine nuts. Pine nuts grow in here galore. Everyone mm-hmm. eats pesto. Everybody eats pine nuts. They're paying like $25 a pound, and it's growing right there in the tree over there off the road, you know. And half the time, I think people know it, you know. So I'm like, have pine nuts around. They're like, oh my God, what is this? I'm all pine nuts, and I'll show them. And they're like, I never knew that. So then we have California grapes that are like great. They just have little seeds in them. Mm-hmm. But we have, there's just, to me, there's bay laurel nuts, you know, like mm-hmm. they're edible. God, there's just so many. There's like, and even there used to be roots. So the there's this brodia, this Indian potato, we call it. Oh, we call it blue dicks. I don't know why. It's called, they're like purple blue, purple flowers, but their whole bulb is a potato. And they used to be on every mountainside and going everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the way they are, they have these rhizomes that you have to gather them in order for them to spread. So once they stop being ignored and they stop being gathered, they stop existing. So the harvesting is what they need. Mm-hmm. So you just don't see a restaurant going in and getting your Indian potatoes with your salmon and, you know, your pine nuts and all of that gathered out there yet. But sure. That would be a cuisine where people understand that's California Indian. And even different, it's like you can go up to Karuk and other, like, you know, further a little bit out where the colonial grab was a little bit harder to reach. You know, they couldn't get their covered wagons through the Iron Mountains as well. Mm-hmm. Sure. And over the Klamath, seriously. You know. So, but they showed up, but it was a slower roll over there. Mm-hmm. And so their diet and some of the things that they have are still like just part of that, part of their world. So you'll see tanoke mushrooms and all the mushrooms that you get to eat up there in that area, mm-hmm. and with the salmon and eel. And just a lot of foods that you don't really get in restaurants mm-hmm. Here, and you really can't get it authentic. It means that they're kind of cooked in someone's home or cooked at a ceremony. But you know, it's just that's one of those things where you don't want to get commercialized too much. But at the same time, you've got unmanaged land, mm-hmm. and you have all this product sitting out there. And apparently, that's what makes people move. I'm like studying capitalism a little bit. People want to have prosperity and wealth. But we can generate it right here. We don't have to put tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of gasoline and mileage in it when we can produce the product right here and gather it. If there's 180,000 acres of federal forestry and you have TEK and technicians out there not only managing the land, but actually pulling products from that and putting that into the economy, that's what you call a Green New Deal.
That's interest. That's worth the interest. To pull back to a thing you were saying about how people, the dishes people are using in Thanksgiving. As this airs, this will be the day after people celebrate Thanksgiving. And so I would like to just give you an opportunity to educate people for maybe next year, mm-hmm. things that they can make to celebrate for this area.
I think everyone should go ahead and try their hand at acorn gathering, mm-hmm. and baking your own acorn flour.
Okay.
Now, acorn flour, everyone's like, acorn flour is not very tasty, but I'm going to tell you, then go dip your finger into your bleached
regular
white
flour, yeah.
and stick your finger in and tell me how tasty that is, too. So go ahead and add that into your ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You can make cookies out of it. You can keep it really wholesome and add honey and nuts and kind of things that you want.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that go ahead and find, because this is a great acorn year, and it takes about a year to dry out your acorn.
Okay.
So this would be great to grab your acorns for next Thanksgiving,
mm-hmm.
dry them out. Now, when you go ahead and YouTube if you need to, the whole processing.
Sure.
There's plenty of YouTubes out
mm-hmm.
there, and I encourage it because I like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's times when you're going to find out if you have weevils and good.
Mm-hmm.
My best suggestion is if you can pull the acorns off the tree and then pop the cap off real easily, then you got a good one.
Okay.
Pretty much any acorn that's hit the ground has only got a matter of minutes before it's being invaded by a pest.
Okay.
Or like a bug.
Mm-hmm.
So, and since we're not having fires and burning all the bugs down, we have, we're loaded down there with bugs. So, pull them off the tree, grab them, dry them out, get them nice and dry. If you're going to see if they're good, if you soak them in water, the ones that are floating, go ahead and discard those.
Mm-hmm.
All the ones that are nice and healthy will sink to the bottom. Just drain it. Dry those out. It takes about 6 months to dry, but we can dry it all the way out for the year.
Okay.
Crack them open, blend them up, put them in your coffee blender if you want, but go ahead and filter that out, what you call leaching.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff that you want to YouTube to be good. And then dry it off and make your flour.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is a great opportunity because we live in the land of oaks here.
Okay.
And if the protein in your acorn is so valuable that you're not going to find a natural flour, a flour that you can make for your cooking, like that's out in nature, like you can an acorn,
mm-hmm.
that holds all of the protein that you need. So this is protein. This is good nutrients. So this is a practice that we really have to get into and not, spend so much time with leaf blowers pushing acorns away and
mm-hmm.
trying to get rid of them as if they were a nuisance, but to actually turn around and start picking them up and pulling them off the trees and cherishing them, because I think, to me, that is a great measure of change that we can all do.
And so that is a way of giving reverence to the land and the original tenders of this land and the Machupta people. And it's one step to, when you're speaking and doing engagements and events, to give acknowledgement to the people, and it's another to actually go out and live in a way that gives acknowledgement to the land, that to the people whose land that you're occupying. And so I would like to give you a moment to just speak to that.
Yeah, I think land acknowledgements are really good as far as like showing alliance, because it's a lot of times the least that someone can do is like, hey, we don't have a relationship with the Machupta Tribal Council. I just, I'm really supportive and everything. But the least I could do at the beginning of this is acknowledge that we're on Machupta territory. And that is an act of decolonization, because of the act of colonization is to take away the political power and integrity of the indigenous folks. So in order to decolonize is to place it back and say, oh, it is yours. It is yours. So I will acknowledge this is Machupta territory. And that is an act of decolonization based on the definition of colonization.
Mm-hmm.
It's to acknowledge it back. So I totally believe in that. But it should be a process.
Mm.
And so just like protests are not the end game, right? So you've seen me in many of protests, and I go out there and I'll like get people riled up. But then just to round them up and say, and we're going to be done to protesting now and going on to the next phase of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm doing this workforce development and getting millions of dollars. I ain't no joke. I'm a beast. I said what I was going to do and I'm going to do it. But that's kind of like how those protests go. So even this land acknowledgement is just like, not only are you going to acknowledge it as a sense, decolonization, But then when we come up with the workforce and we're asking for contracts and we're working, you're going to acknowledge that we're working.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thank you for your time here. And I definitely want to give you an opportunity to speak to anything you have on your mind that you think is pressing for the peoples of Chico.
Chico. You know, there's probably a great audience listening right now. I want to speak to the audience that, you know, listens to KZFR, really engaged in the history of not only the Machupta here, but also the other neighboring tribes and their process. Their process of surviving genocide. And the survival of genocide kind of puts most of us tribes in this post-apocalyptic time. And but the society here is just going into the pre-dawn of their apocalypse. And so there's this narrative of kind of being the old gangster on the block that's been through a lot and knows the nature of things well enough to know who to mess with and who not to mess with and what to say and what not to say. And I think it's come down to that big brother, little brother time in Chico, where the residents who've been here for so long and said they never knew that they were on Machupta territory. They never knew the history of this place. They never even knew it before 180 years ago and believe that California has been here for 450 years and it has not. It is brand new. And so since you started the state based on genocide, it is up to you, Chico, California, and you, Butte County, and you, allies, to work together with the tribes. We are working together with the community in order to basically reconcile the genocide, the $5 scalp bounty that was put on all of our citizens of all of our nations in order to build the state of California. To make it right, we're going to have to work together on land management and turn this economy, which is the number one economy in the United States, into an economy with integrity, true democracy, balance, and intelligence. And that's what California should stand for. And I think a lot of people in this nation love to listen to and hang out with California people because we're so cool, you know. But we're only cool until when people realize that half the people here talk the talk but don't walk the walk. And so what it comes down to is no one's really had an opportunity to do what they've always wanted to do. And so if I could be a gatekeeper and if I could be opening up that gate and saying, yo, I'm going to try to put together, along with a group of other people that believe in this project, to give people the opportunity to certify themselves to do land management and to be a land tech, then that is the next future. We will not be put on the map because of the campfire. We'll be put on the map because of how we readjusted our vision to work with indigenous people to build this ecology-minded, healthy place for the future. And this is not just an example to the United States, but to the world, on how to treat the indigenous people in your community and collectively make them partners and basically what they call stakeholders and the ecology. So we should be at the planning stages. And so I just want to tell Chico that I'm there for them to help this opportunity become basically a new Chico State campus by way of Chico State, you know, but also by way of using traditional ecological knowledge and other certifications. And hopefully this will not put people in any kind of debt, but put people on top again in prosperity and make the wild, wild west a beautiful thing.
This is Corey Hunt speaking on KZFR with Machupta tribal member, activist, and educator, Allie Mitters-Knight.
So, around the topic of Indian, being called Indians or Native, Indigenous people, a tribe, a nation, community. What are your thoughts around that? Is there a preferred nomenclature?
Well, I believe that tribal nations have not been recognized to being the tribal nations. So when you're looking, I'm always talking about the Marshall Trilogy, you know. It's the Discovery Doctrine. It basically says the United States says that, you know, all tribal nations are to only have a relationship with Congress, the national level. That's why you have BIA. That's why you have all these big, national, programs sitting in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So this relationship that the tribes have are supposed to be with, nation to nation, to the U.S. Capitol, to the tribe themselves. So that makes the state and the municipal and all corporations, they basically legally said that they are not to do direct relationships with the tribes, that the tribes are to do it through Congress. Mm-hmm. So Congress, it's kind of like a keeper, a brother's keeper. So the tribes are in trust almost to the federal government. And that's why a lot of times people see reservations and people living on reservations as still being political prisoners of war, because those places were set aside. So we are still numbered. I have a tribal ID number. I still have a federal ID number that's different, not just social security number. Mm-hmm. It's because I have two citizenships. Mm. I'm a citizen of the United States, and I'm a citizen of the Machupta Nation. Mm. So I have two nationalities. And so my two nationalities are United States and my tribe. So when you speak of the Machupta, you're actually saying that's a tribal nation. So that is a nation. That is a country in a way. Mm-hmm. So Machupta would be a country the way we would say, a big one, Canada, or we look at Great Britain, and then there's France. Someone's a citizen of the country, the nation of France. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a citizen of the country, the nation of Machupta. And so, and it's tough because of that United States, they believe that blood quantum on it, that would quantify my ethnicity. But if you go to France and you have a French citizen, that doesn't mean that it quantifies his ethnicity as French. Mm-hmm. He's a citizen of France. So going back to this, when you work with the United States and you're saying, I want to talk about all tribal nations, mm-hmm. you can say all tribal nations, and that will fit. Unfortunately, the United States of America has written into the Constitution and all their policies, Indian. Mm. So we are Indian in the name of the United States. So we have federal Indian law, Indian this, Indian that, American Indian Health, BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs. All of that stuff is because the United States refuses to give up the idea that we're not from India and we've been misnamed. They're like doubling down on it. And so now it's been like 450 years that we've been called Indians here. So, technically, we respond to the name, we answer to the name Indian, especially when it's in federal Indian law. Mm-hmm. So, but when people know me, they'll be like, Ali's Machupta. But I'm also Kunkau, Wintu, Nomalaki, from my family tree. Mm-hmm. So these are other nations, and that's a whole other story, but the United States does not allow a native to be enrolled into two different tribal nations. You can only pick one. So if you're related to four, you can only have one that you can be citizens to. You can't be citizens to like three different tribes or four, one, even two. So the controllingness of this is big. So when we're going to have to answer to and have pretty much a bit in our mouth by the federal government, it gets really burdensome to deal with municipals and states and counties that are completely unaware of it and want to act as landlords nations, to the tribes, yeah. Mm-hmm. to the nations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm like, gosh, it's a nation. Why are you? Yeah. And so, in that perspective, I hope that answers your question, that yes. There's just different names. And I've never really seen a lot of people get hung up on it in Indian country, as we call it, because we have so many names, and like if you saw the huge response on Facebook to something else, we have a great sense of humor about being labeled things. Mm-hmm. I think Native American wrote so many memes on being called something else by CNN mm-hmm. that I had some memes that I posted, and I'm not a meme person, but it's funny. Mm-hmm. And so we make a lot of jokes about it because it's dark, but it's hilarious the way that we've been mislabeled. We've been so much propaganda. We're still surviving, and we're still pushing forward, and we still have good grace. And And I'll claim that for all Native people, we have good grace.
Such a resilient peoples. In closing, I have a thing where I ask my interviewees to give me three questions they ask themselves or encourage others to ask themselves to stay grounded, moving forward, and being efficient, and like one proverb.
Okay. All right. So one proverb. I might have to go backwards. I said this proverb before, but it's been in my mind. The proverb is, what do you do first thing in the morning? And feed the children. And I always loved that proverb because when I first heard it, I thought that the first thing you do is pray.
That's intense.
And then when the answer was feed the children, I realized in my own processing that feeding children is a prayer in itself.
Yes.
And, you know, so that's going into one of the things that I ask myself moving forward a lot is I've spent a lot of time through my life trying to have a lot of trauma awareness for myself. Mm. And I go through trauma therapy and kind of know my triggers and know my responses, not to be in control of myself, but just to be self-aware. And I don't mind being honest with myself. And I learned that a lot from, like, you know, living in Los Angeles around some old school, like AA, you know, old timers, man, you know, they're like, to thine own self be true. No, I mean it, you know? And I think processing to thine own self be true and being honest with myself, and even if the truth is ugly and hurtful and bitter, that I can hold that truth for myself and I can hold that space. And so that's being true to myself and saying the truth and knowing that it's trauma related. Mm. That if I'll start lying to myself, and once I'm, you know, that's a form of trauma. And so to be healthy is about living in that realm of honesty. And then I think the one thing that I've always carried with me from, I lived in Amelia Island after I had my twins for a while. My life was falling apart. I gave up my job. I gave up my house in California, and I went to Florida. And I was only there for like 8 months. I had to come back. But anyway, I was there. And I was there for a reason, because I met some really cool people. And one lady, she really was like, you know what holds people up a lot in life is resentment. You know, and I was like, you know, that's so true. You know, that energy, that yucky power. And, you know, deal with that a lot, especially talking about history of genocide and this, you know, it can be heavy. You know, it hurts, you know. So do I carry this resentment? Do I carry that pain? Mm-hmm. And then I have to focus on trauma and being honest with myself. So this is just this full circle conversation I have with myself a lot. Sure. And so there's this mantra that, you know, I even have it kind of tattooed on me right here, and I have it on my necklace here. Mm-hmm. Is I lovingly and willingly forgive and release myself to my highest good, praying only for love, peace, health, and prosperity. Mm. And then if I have a resentment and say I'm like, you know, can say I'm mad at, let's throw this out here for now just for the air, but just say I have a resentment with Chico PD and I need to get through my day and not let the energy affect me, mm-hmm. then I'm going to lovingly and willingly forgive and release them to their highest good, praying only for love, peace, health, and prosperity. Because I know if they have love, peace, health, and prosperity, they wouldn't be worried about killing nobody.
That's powerful. Can I get one last question from you that you ask yourself?
One last question I ask myself is, am I thirsty? So I can drink water so I'm hydrated. It's called HALT. Am I hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? Mm-hmm. So if I'm hungry, if I'm angry, I'm lonely, and I'm tired, it's usually an indication I got to take care of that first before I handle something, because those things can affect my behavior, my thinking, and even my self-esteem. And so, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And you can handle all that, but those are questions that just to check myself, you know, before I wreck myself.
Allie Mitters-Knight, thank you so much for giving us this time and sharing your wisdom with us and all the works that you've done in our community. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Oh, thank you. I had a great time. I hope everyone does too.
Thank you again to Allie Mitters-Knight for sharing her wealth of information. And anyone interested in joining in on land tending can check at tekchico.org. That's tekchico.org for more information on certification updates and opportunities for tending the land. And that's been another amazing episode of Sapient Sessions. Thank you again to Allie Mitters-Knight and you all for tuning in. And as always, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. This is Hemp C, Corey Hunt, Soapbox, signing out.
Another great session, and Corey will be with you also next Friday for two segments, and I'm looking forward to that also. This is Chris. I'm looking forward to playing Dead Being in the House today, but they may not be, in which case we will go to Radio Paradise. Wanted to announce that there are three new public affairs shows starting up in the first week of December here at KZFR. Sue Hildebrand, who is the host of the Wednesday night 6 p.m. news show, and is going to be doing another news show. And then there is also Chico News and Review is going to be having a show. And that's going to be really exciting. I'm looking forward to both of those. And Bobby Tryon returns to KZFR doing an interview show with nonprofits. So we've got three to look forward to, and they'll be very exciting. So it's 12:58. I want to thank our underwriters for the Peace and Justice show. I want to thank Quicksilver Courier Service, which is the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And Sonia Airy, Allstate Insurance Agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and goals. For more information about protecting your life, home, vehicle, or boat, or to roll over your 401k account, call Sonia at 345-2351. And I hate to put you back through the community calendar again. I know I played it inappropriately, but we're going to play it again. It looks like Rick's in the house to do Playing Dead, so stay tuned. He'll be with you in just a second. And let's see if I can get this on for you. And stay well, everyone. Enjoy
from CYA
your weekend.
To the penitentiary.
Here we go.
Hey, KZFR listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar. I'm Matt Fidler. Happy Thanksgiving week. This Tuesday, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Butte County Library, Chico Branch, which is at 1108 Sherman Avenue in Chico, is the group Angels with Heart. Angel Kids will be cooking up some tasty treats again this year. Their goal is to feed the hungry and to serve up some smiles, too. So if you're hungry, please come and join the Angels and get a plate and some dessert all to go. They will have turkey, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, candied yams, rolls, baked mac and cheese, pumpkin pie, cake, and cookies. Warm hat and mittens also while supplies last. This Wednesday, in fact, every other Wednesday until at least the end of January 2021, the Stonewall Alliance is having a teens trans night from 6:30 to 8 p.m. If you're a trans teen, come join and meet other teenagers and just be yourself at the Stonewall Alliance, 358 East 6th Street in Chico.